Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For the past year, CAP Radio producers, editors, and reporters have been listening to residents in North Sacramento, known as City Council District 2. All this week, we've been sharing conversations about some of the issues facing the area, from homelessness to a lack of investment and a drought of resources for youth. Among the issues we heard about is the area's inadequate representation at City Hall. And now, Councilmember Sean Lalowie, who represents the district, is currently under an independent investigation because of claims he does not live there. But he isn't District 2's first divisive politician. Joining us now are CAP Radio's Janelle Salonga and Kristen Lamb. Janelle is our Sacramento Communities reporter, and Kristen covers local government. Janelle and Kristen, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Well, Kristen, starting with you, for those who aren't familiar with District 2, what communities does it include?
It includes Northeast Sacramento neighborhoods like Del Paso Heights, Hagenwood, Strawberry Manor, Woodlake, and Old North Sacramento. It's largely a low-income district and is pretty diverse. There are sizable Latino, Black, Hmong, and Russian communities there. But for our story that published today, Janelle and I focused on Del Paso Heights and Del Paso Boulevard, which lies south of and is not part of Del Paso Heights.
And Janelle, I mean, I learned this, you know, through this reporting and this year-long endeavor that North Sacramento used to be its own sovereign city and was actually annexed by the city of Sacramento. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, like you said, part of District 2 actually used to be its own city until 1965. So that's when that annexation happened. And before that, North Sacramento was incorporated as a city in 1924. So in 2 years, in 2024, it would have been the city's 100th year founding anniversary.
Yeah, the centennial. Any longtime residents doing anything to celebrate?
That's a little bit of a loaded question, actually, because for a long time, Del Paso Heights resident Mina Perez, the anniversary is a chance for her to look at where funding and support for the city hasn't really come through and where some investments need to be made. Here are some of her thoughts on approaching the 100 years.
That should be a celebration. We should have a better grocery store, a bank. We should have a better place where our kids can go, maybe have a splash of water, a park.
Yeah, I mean, what they're talking about, Kristen, is a lack of basic resources that has long been an issue. In what ways have residents said that these needs are connected to inadequate representation at City Hall?
People disagreed on exactly how long District 2 has been underrepresented, but answers ranged from since the 70s to around 14 years. And Perez told me some representatives haven't invested in giving back to the community. She said that some outsiders have come in and extracted wealth from places like Del Paso, buying up land and selling it for a profit. And Del Paso Heights resident Deborah Cummings also told me that representatives haven't had skin in the game or a stake in the community. She says it's meaningful for representatives to be from and still live in the area.
Yeah, well, let's dive into what Deborah means by meaningful representation. The current council member is Sean Lalowie, currently under an independent investigation over allegations he didn't live or doesn't live in the district that he represents, which is legally required, but actually in an upscale neighborhood in neighboring Placer County. We're going to get into that in a moment, but how have his predecessors fared?
So Cummings said that Lalowie's predecessor, Alan Warren, was also polarizing. Warren represented the district from 2012 to 2020. She said some people loved him, while others questioned why he couldn't bring more positive development to District 2, considering his work as a real estate developer. There were rumors he didn't live in the district while in office either, but he didn't face a residency investigation like Lalowie. Here's Deborah Cummings.
We have been separated by politics, and politics, it's a bad thing. Our kids are dying in the street, our young women, you know, we're seeing pregnancy on the rise. We have nothing to offer our teenagers, especially jobs. I mean, and that would make you split up. You know, so you got people over here wanting to be on this team, and then you got your community over here saying, hey, wait a minute, something is wrong. But I tell people, you have to get on board with rebirthing the community. It's not about me. It's about the community. And you got to start building back what we lost. And the fighting and the bickering over funds, because there are none.
What Deborah's talking about are issues that spanned multiple elected officials in North Sacramento. Moving to present day, what's the latest with the investigation into council member Sean Lalowie?
So Lalowie agreed to cooperate with an independent investigation back on July 1st. Mayor Daryl Steinberg had asked him to agree to one after the Sacramento Bee first reported allegations that he does not live in his Hagenwood house, but instead lives in Granite Bay. But the city hasn't given any updates on the investigation since then. Lalowie himself told me that he can't speak on the ongoing investigation when I caught him at a rally 2 weeks ago. But he did say he thinks the investigation is a political attack.
Yesterday, we spoke with Danielle Savala with the Del Paso Boulevard Partnership on Insight with Randall White about investments he'd like to see in North Sacramento. He, along with Perez, were part of a group of neighborhood leaders calling for an investigation into Councilmember Lalowie, and he shared some thoughts with you about it. What did he have to say, Janelle?
Well, Savala is no stranger to working with and in city government. While he's currently the executive director of the Del Paso Boulevard Partnership, he spent some time working for District 2's previous council member, Warren. Savala says,
The biggest thing, the unfortunate thing, is the distraction that this is. It's distracting us from serving people who live in North Sacramento.
He also told me that he thinks elected officials need to work on bridging the communication gap between themselves and residents. So, for example, talking about, you know, what are an elected official's main three priorities when they want to come in and serve the community. Lalowie has, you know, a newsletter that people in his district can sign up to, but obviously not everyone has internet access, an email, or a computer. So it definitely remains to be seen how, you know, he and other members of city staff and city council continue to do outreach with and form partnerships in the community that kind of address what residents, including Savala, are saying.
Right. And Kristen, you caught Council Member Lalowie at a rally. This is his first term as council member representing District 2. What did he have to say about inadequate representation?
Yeah, he said the state of District 2 has been embarrassing for the past 30 to 40 years. He said that the city has taken advantage of District 2 and called the residents there resilient and tough. And Lalowie says one of his main issues is that the city seems to only approve cannabis, discount stores, and affordable housing in District 2. And he wants to see the city invest in other ways. And that lines up with what residents told us. They want there to be more opportunities and resources for young people in particular.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio reporters Janelle Salonga and Kristen Lamb on some of the issues residents in North Sacramento shared about underrepresentation and underfunding from City Hall. All right, Janelle, let's get to what opportunities and resources actually exist. What's available for children in the area?
Yeah, so some of the things that are available, there are programming classes available through the Hope Center, which Sean Tao talked about on Insight yesterday with Randall. There's the Robertson Community Center, which actually was vaccination and test free COVID-19 testing site. And that's near Skate Park near the Robertson Park. There's also, you know, a children's playground, a soccer lawn at Robert Brookins Park, and a swimming pool at the Johnston Community Center that offers swim classes. And of course, you know, there's Grant Union High's football stadium. And so in season, that's, you know, kind of a place that families can go to watch games. But even with all of this, you know, one big obstacle that we heard about is transportation.
Yeah, because children don't necessarily have cars and not necessarily their parents either, right?
Yeah, exactly. Cummings was born and raised in Del Paso Heights, and she told us that most people, from seniors to parents, use public transportation to get places.
We are in the summer, and there, as we know, triple-digit temperatures. How do they handle the heat? Are they able to go to swimming pools in the area?
Well, Cummings told Kristen that it's been really tough. Each summer, she said, hours for the Johnston swimming pool can fluctuate. And so when that happens, the closest like aquatic center for kids to cool down is in North Natomas. And so kids need to be lucky enough to catch a bus or to have parents or a friend drop them off at the center. She's thankful that the Johnston pool reopened at the end of July for kids who aren't able to make it that far north. But she said that water facilities in the area, like the Johnston pool, because of their fluctuating hours, need more consistent investment.
Yeah, that consistency is key. How did you find people to talk to for this story?
So Perez and Zavala, like was mentioned earlier, both signed a letter calling for the city to hire an independent investigator to review Sean Lowy's residency. And both of them, along with Cummings, also participated in listening sessions that Jessica Maria Ross, our former community engagement manager, and two participatory engagement fellows working with her held last summer. So Ross and the fellows spoke to over 100 people and created a report and a list of contacts for reporters to continue the conversation with.
Yeah, and really allowing residents to lead the way. Kristen, do people have any hesitation speaking openly about some of these contentious issues?
Yes, someone I spoke with actually asked to rescind her interview after we spoke, partly because of concerns. We were looking to report something specific, like we already had something in mind. And to some extent, I think you do have to determine a focus when setting out to report an article. And when District 2 City Council members have been so divisive, it makes sense that people might be wary of how their comments will be put into context.
Looking ahead, is there any funding coming to the district?
So yesterday evening, the council approved a rough plan of $5 million for economic recovery in North Sacramento. The money will go towards issues ranging from food insecurity to small business assistance. But the $5 million comes from one-time federal funding, specifically from the American Rescue Plan Act related to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, and it's hard to plan for the future if you don't have sustainable funding, right?
Of course.
And that is Janelle Salonga, our Sacramento Communities reporter, and Kristen Lamb, who covers local Sacramento government. Thank you both for joining us this morning and sharing your reporting.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Their reporting has been published this morning, and you can read it at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. This summer, I escaped triple-digit temperatures and took a trip up Highway 101 through the Lost Coast. I continued up north to Del Norte County, just south of the Oregon border, to the heart of California's redwoods, and also home to the Yurok tribe. The tribe is the largest in the state, with land that extends up the coastline along the Klamath River, which is the longest wild and scenic river in California. But while the Yurok tribe is rich in remote beauty, I learned the tribe is among the poorest in the state, undergoing a revival in economic development to restore priceless cultural traditions at risk of being lost. One of the traditions being restored hand-carved canoes from California redwoods. Canoe captain Julian Markison, culture bearer Hop Norris, and canoe builder David Eric Severance took me on a serene voyage that shares the history of Yurok culture and a way of life that goes back centuries. The song you're going to hear is titled Nepoi Rekwa from Yurok singer James Gensaw Sr. Known as Great Fishermen, the Klamath River has long been a lifeline for the Yurok tribe. And Julian Markison is part of a new generation restoring what he calls a lost art. Alongside modern jet boats, we travel back to a sacred tradition, traveling the river on canoes from handmade redwoods.
When did you start learning this process?
About 2 years ago. I never thought I would be involved in this, but they needed some paddlers last year, and so they asked me, and I just fell in love with it because there's nothing like it, really, being involved in your culture and it being all brand new and something that nobody's been doing for quite some time now. It's a little bit of a lost art.
It just feels so peaceful also.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I'm in Del Norte County, which is the furthest north county to the west along the Pacific Ocean, just south of the Oregon border. And I'm standing on the bank of the Klamath River, about 5 miles from the mouth of the river into the Pacific Ocean. And before we hop on this canoe trip with the Yurok tribe, which is the largest tribe in California, I just got to tell you, it is so remotely peaceful. We are surrounded by redwoods and fern. And I got to tell you, coming from the Sacramento Valley in triple digit temperatures, we're at least 40 degrees cooler. It's like a rainforest.
Before we embark on our redwood canoe tour, Julian explains the tallest tree in the world is treated with deep respect.
So these are our canoes right here. We believe that they're living just like you and I. And one of the ways that we do that is we give it all the necessary body parts to live.
There are two canoes side by side on the riverbank, roughly 20 feet long and 3 feet wide. As Julian runs his hand alongside the edges, he explains each redwood is considered a living being, just like humans.
So if you look right here, this is actually the nose of the canoe. And whenever you're handling this canoe, you never want to grab right here, because nobody likes getting pulled around by their nose, right? But in all reality, this is the short grain of the redwood, so it's really easy to just pop right off. And then we'd have an out-of-commission canoe. And if you look a little bit closer right here, these are the lungs of the canoe, these indentions right here. And then they're also connected to the heart, just like you and I. And then we're also always going to have this lifeline for the continuance of life that goes all the way around. And then if you look at the two notches in the back, those are the kidneys for purification and good thought. And then we also got the heart right here. And back in the day, you wouldn't even get into one of these canoes if it didn't have a heart. It's kind of like, you know, the energy was off and it keeps balance and all that. And then lastly, we have the seat in the back. And because at the end of the day, what do? We rest, right? So that's what that signifies, is make sure to rest.
Julian explains both canoes are two halves carved from the same redwood log and are considered different genders.
That's Big Baby. He's the guy. And then we just found out the name of this one. This one's Bertha. It's named after the canoe builder, Dave's grandma. So, yeah, and then this is the girl, and that's the boy right there. So you could tell that they're a little bit different.
We hop into Bertha and begin traveling along the Klamath River.
Do you know how long these canoes can last for?
Yeah, so if you take care of them properly, these can last for over 100 years.
Each redwood completes its life cycle as a tree before transforming into a dugout canoe.
We would never cut down a log. We like to think that the redwood chooses to be a log or not. So we'll actually only take fallen ones.
Julian is the canoe captain sitting in the back, joined up front by Yurok guide Hop Norris.
H-O-P, like short for jump. Norris, like Chuck, but no relation.
Hop has lived on Yurok land for the majority of his life.
Our people, we're all the same, but we're kind of different. We identify ourselves by where we come from, where we village we come from. And here along this hillside right here, this is Hopau Village. And that's where my family comes from, my people. We dance people, we're what they call medicine people.
Explaining that a proper introduction leads with where you're from, followed by your name.
When you tell somebody where you're from, then they can have an understanding of how to interact with you, because the idea being that we're class people, and you know, dance families, medicine families, magic families being the highest class people, and then, you know, down it goes like that. And so when I say I'm from Hopau and my name's Hop, now everybody knows that, okay, he's from over here, and you interact with them a certain way. The idea being kind of like, you don't interact the same way with your boss as you do with your wife. You don't interact the same way with your mother as you do with your brother. You know, that kind of idea. So I know who I'm speaking with, so I know how to behave. I know how to address you and that type of thing like that. So we would say where we're from first and then say our name.
The bond between Redwood and Yurok goes back centuries, spanning generations, but like countless Native American traditions, became endangered.
This is all very new to us as well. You know, it's something that's a lost art and a lost culture, and a lost part of our culture that's being currently revived. And so it's awesome when sometimes get to stop by and speak with these guys, and they'll, you know, give us little tidbits of information that we don't have, and that now we can share with you.
It's the importance of oral tradition, passing it on.
Absolutely. Myself, I'm known what's known as a culture bearer, and that means basically that I have a lot of knowledge about the culture and stuff. And this is something that's new to me as well, even as a culture bearer. And so, that, you know, there's never a time to stop learning, no matter how old you become. Cause I'm a little bit older than these guys.
Gliding on a hand-built redwood canoe is serene.
Today we might see some otters. There's a lot of birds on this river. May see some fish jump here and there. Right now is what we call spring salmon season.
A quiet solitude historically reserved only for the Yurok tribe to protect their culture and symbiotic relationship with the environment.
We're fisher people, salmon people. You know, it said that if there's no salmon, then there's no reason for the Pulik Lot for us to exist, that we have no purpose if there's no fish. And so that's how closely we are tied to these salmon that are in this water.
Sharing their traditions and history with the public represents a shift in trust and openness.
I do have a lot of jokes. I'm a pretty funny guy. You know, if I wasn't doing this, I'd be in stand-up. But the stories and stuff, you know, we have a lot. You can see interacting and you hear us when we're all together. And there's a lot of laughter and a lot of good times and good feelings amongst each other and that type of stuff. And we're that way amongst each other, you know, and we're finally learning to be that way with others. Because for a long time, we weren't that way. You know, when settlers first got here, we wouldn't speak with them. We wouldn't talk with them. And they were like, who are you people? And we wouldn't speak with them, our people. And they had to go up the river to the Karuks and say, who are those people down there? You know, and they said, that's the Yuruks. They call us the Yuruks. For them, that means coastal people. And so the settlers couldn't say Yuruks. They say Yurok. And they say, oh, well, we just call them the Clammouth people because they don't speak. You know, and that's actually where this name Klamath come from. There's an evolution of that name Clammouth that they gave our people because we wouldn't speak to them. And so, but amongst each other, you know, it's all cordial and fun and good times and happy and like that. And so we're finally learning to share that with the world. And that's kind of part of what these tours are doing, is allowing us to share of ourselves with the rest of the world.
Hop describes a Klamath River that once carried an interstate of canoes until an atmospheric river known as the Christmas Flood of 1964 decimated the Pacific Northwest and Yurok land.
Settlers first got here, it was described as a redwood canoe highway. hundreds of canoes going up and down each side of this river. And even in old pictures before 1964, if you look at old pictures of the river, there's all kinds of these canoes intermixed with the more modern boats as well, up until 1964. During the flood, all of them got washed out and hardly any of them that were recovered. And then the knowledge was lost.
That knowledge is now being salvaged. Julian estimates there are less than a dozen redwood canoes today.
There's only about 11 of these in existence. So this is one of the rarest vessels in the world right here.
And Hop jumps in to add that canoe captains like Julian are few and far between.
So another cool thing about these canoes is that there's only about 20 people in the world that can drive them with any type of skill or be considered a captain in that.
Now, when it comes to crafting redwood canoes, to become a carver is years, even decades, in the making. The canoe we're riding on, Bertha, was built by Yurok tribal member David Eric Severance, which is my next stop when back on land.
I was lucky. I was raised around old people. I got to learn a lot of stuff. I know way more stuff than this canoe building. But this is my baby. I love this.
Standing in front of his next canoe in the making, David shares the redwood Yurok origin story.
But there's a story of a redwood tree, and the redwood tree wanted to live amongst the humans. And the Creator gave him that opportunity to live amongst the humans by giving us canoes. And that's how the redwood tree lives with man. So we treat this with the utmost respect like we would another family member.
David's craft is more than skill, but also an awareness that redwood canoes require the building blocks of a healthy relationship.
First thing I do is come and I introduce myself to the canoe, tell them I'm here to work on it, and then I say a prayer for the canoe and for everybody that works on it. And I'll walk all the way around it with my hand on it till I get back where I started. And that's how I start my day. And I always feel good. And you never work on these when you're angry or with somebody else. You know, we've been really lucky. We have, you know, people with addiction problems and stuff, but they never come over here. And when my boys work on it, we talk about those people. You know, I'll say, you know, see so-and-so, because they're relatives to us. He's even family friends. I said, you know, it's too bad he can't be over here, but that's how he chooses to live. And the idea is to encourage my boys that if this is the life they're going to choose, be responsible for the life of a canoe, then they can't live like that. And that my hope is that keeps them from ever living like that.
The Yurok canoe tours allow the tribe to rebuild their culture, but also by offering tours to the public, it helps overcome another challenge, cost. The Yurok tribe may be the largest in the state, but struggles in economic development.
We are the poorest tribe in California. Our casino, it looks pretty. It really doesn't do anything. It does create a few jobs, but that's it.
The casino is part of a Holiday Inn Express along a beautifully scenic but remote stretch of Highway 101, just south of the Oregon border. Far from the size of the more established tribal casinos, and cell service is spotty at best.
For where we were 25 years ago, we're doing well, but we're not doing near as well as Marengo and other tribes.
Another challenge, supply. Now, if you remember, the redwood decides when it becomes a canoe. The Yurok doesn't cut them down. David says acquiring a log is difficult, and the price is high to transport it onto tribal land.
You can have all the teachers in the world. If you don't have the material, it's just not going to happen. And we experimented in the past with logs that were pretty much junk, but the tribe itself doesn't own big timber. That's been taken away by timber companies or lost through mismanagement of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. But now, our partnership with the parks and BLM, we're starting to get logs. But then again, we fall in the dilemma is how do we afford to bring them logs home? But through this Yurok Economic Development, that's happened. So the opportunity to continue doing this is coming solely from the tours taking them rides. I mean, it's sad, but it's important for us.
And it funds the continuing of a tradition that goes back centuries.
Yeah. When I started this one, I was probably the youngest canoe builder out of the five there is. And I was the baby at 50-something. But the rest of them are old men, and a lot of them aren't doing this, and a lot of them don't have students. And like I say, it's hard to have a student because the men that should be learning this, they got families. My boys all got to, you know, pay the rent, pay the mortgage. But when they come up with this idea, I thought, oh, man, that's awesome. And just right up my alley because I like to teach. But that's my goal is to teach. If 100 kids come and do chop on this, out of that 100 kids, I would say 3 kids are going to have the chance to build, are going to remember it.
enough to be able to do it again. Out of them three, one kid's going to get a log. I mean, that's out of 100 kids. And when you think of our membership based here on the res, where the logs are available isn't like most of us, most of tribal members live abroad. And I see why, you know, we don't live in the best area for economics. But out of the, it's the kids that live here that are going to learn this. And that's the ones that walk over and do it.
How long does it take to become a master carver?
Everybody says, oh, you're a master carver. But I hate to call myself that because my teacher's still alive. And that implies I have his skills. And I really don't. My canoes look pretty. His are way better. But I don't know. I don't think it's a matter of time. I think it's more a matter of how many canoes. And I don't think it's just being able to build a canoe. I think most people could if they put their mind to it and had the time and the log. But I think to be able to do it over and over with consistency, quite a few years. I learned 14 years ago was the first canoe I built. And I've been around them ever since. Some guys learn faster than others. I have a little guy that's 13. He's going to be a canoe builder. He knows this stuff. And when I go to other places and I teach, I'll visit with the adults and he'll jump in and be the teacher for the day. It's pretty cool. It's, you have been in there long enough. Let these other guys have a turn. It's cute. It's pretty cool.
That must feel so nice seeing a 13-year-old knowing that they're going to continue on what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, ain't just that, too. How many 13-year-olds can say I'm a canoe builder or I know enough about it to build one? So, yeah, it's a big deal. It's just, you know, it's just our goal, our camp's goal, is to keep our kids out of trouble through culture. And then again, we're stuck with that dilemma of traditional culture and what materials are available, such as the redwood tree. So things aren't like they used to be, but we're trying to keep it as traditional as we can.
This trip along the Klamath River, guided by the Yurok tribe, is a truly special experience, but also a hard, necessary history lesson of a way of life nearly destroyed. Which is why, while guiding me on the river, Hop Norris said he was initially against welcoming outsiders.
I was actually one of the loudest voices against it. Yeah, and at the time I felt like we was pimping our culture out, you know, and several factors that changed my mind in that, and one being that I grew up being told that we don't share, you know. I was blessed to be raised by what they call Indian outlaws, and up until 1978 it was considered to be illegal to practice our ways, to participate in our ceremonies, to even speak our language, and that type of thing was considered to be illegal, punishable by jail. People disappeared and all kind of different things like that, you know. And so we had what they called Indian outlaws, and them people practice our ways in secret, you know, behind closed doors, or go way up in the mountain somewhere and speak the language inside and different things like that. And I was blessed to be raised by those people. And so one of the things that I was taught, though, is that we don't share. This is our ways and this is for us, you know. And although I'm teaching you this so that, they say, I don't teach you this for you. I teach you for your grandchildren's grandchildren to know. And that's why you get to learn this stuff. But we don't share with outside. This is for us, you know. And I it didn't make sense to me that, you know, why don't we share about ourselves? We don't, how can we expect people to come here and interact with us and that type of stuff if they don't know how to behave? If we don't tell them how to behave, then how can they know how to behave? And how do they know they're being disrespectful? You know, it's like a self-conflict that I had for a long time, and especially when this thing came out. And so I was loud against it. And one day I was sitting there talking to somebody, and they're like, well, don't you always say, and I always say this, we can't expect people to respect us if they don't understand us. You know, and who better to teach them than a culture bearer, you know? And so I was like, dang, man, you guys, you know, you got me.
And now, with gracious pride, the bond between Redwood and Yurok remains intact.
Just get out here and you get on the water and you get in one of these things, and it's like going home to the womb or something, you know what I mean? It just feels so wonderful and magical and amazing. And you know, I helped out a little bit, and Julian called me and asked me to come back this year, and this has actually been one of the most satisfying, gratifying, magical, fantastical, beautiful things that I've ever been a part of, and And it gives me hope. You get to see these young fellas over here and you know, they're picking up the mantle and hunger for this stuff. And for a long time growing up, we didn't have hope because I was told you're supposed to be white and you survive in this world by being white. You know, we don't have to tell these men that, and our children, we don't have to tell them that anymore. We get to say that, you know, this is what we are and this is how we are, and that's okay, and people can accept us or not, but we don't have to be hiding anymore, and we don't have to pretend that we're not something that we are. And these guys like this, you know, I'm very hopeful, and it gives me hope as well that not just only my family was doing this, you know, because you don't have to say a lot to these young men to, and they know, you know, don't have to do a lot of speaking. And that's old way, that I don't have to tell you what to do because you already know what to do. And these guys, and they come and it makes my heart really happy to be around them, you know, and they help keep me young a little bit. Again, I won't tell you how old I am, but I'm a little older than them. And so, you know, some factors like that, they help me to become a part of this, you know. And again, and it's become something that I'm in love with, and I hope I get to keep doing it for a long time, especially because I get to capture people on here and they kind of have to laugh at my jokes because otherwise it's awkward.
And young canoe captains like Julian are part of a new generation guiding a resurgence in Yurok culture.
Just bringing an awareness. Hop, he says all the time that, you know, you can't have people respect you if they don't know about you. So, you know, just letting people know who we are and just giving insight on what we do and things that are important to us. So that way, you know, build that bridge of them understanding who we are. So that way we can work together and, you know, build a better future.
What he said.
And that is canoe captain Julian Markison, culture bearer Hop Norris, and canoe builder David Eric Severins, who took me on a beautifully serene voyage that shares the history of Yurok culture and a way of life that goes back centuries. The Yurok Redwood Canoe Tours are open to the public and help fund the restoration of an indigenous tradition. The song that you're listening to is titled Nepoi Rekwa from Yurok singer James Gensaw Sr. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Whimsical strings, trumpets, a hypnotic guitar rhythm, and of course, soaring voices to raise the spirit or break the heart. All of these ingredients are key to mariachi, one of the most distinctive and unmistakable music styles in the world. The iconic music is being celebrated at Mariachi Festival de Sacramento this weekend in downtown Sacramento. The event promises to showcase the beautiful music of Mexico, including a performance by Mariachi Estrella de Mexico, the largest mariachi in the world. Here's them performing Qué Lindo Es México.
En mi vida y en mi sangre, en mi mente y mi corazón, canto fuerte todo el tiempo, la música de mi nación, soy de Huentitán el Alto, con orgullo digo yo.
We are in for a very good ride. Another mariachi you don't want to miss is Mariachi Bonitas, an all-female band created to share the captivating art of mariachi in Northern California. Joining us now is Denora Klingler, manager and lead singer of Mariachi Bonitas and organizer of Mariachi Festival de Sacramento. Denora. Welcome.
Hello, Vicky. What a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Mm-hmm. Now, you're wearing a lot of hats this weekend. You're a lead singer. You're also the organizer for this festival. How did the festival come about?
Okay, well, the festival has existed since 2014. Of course, we had some hiccups here and there because of the pandemic, but we are determined to continue, especially for me, it's very, very important to feature and keep bringing the beautiful mariachi music. So it's a challenge, but we're surviving it, and now we are going for another year.
Yeah, a worthwhile labor of love.
Right.
What can people expect this weekend?
I would call it a beautiful trip to Mexico through music. That's what I see it. Music, it is, you know, like we know, a universal language that connect us to each other. So mariachi music is a trip to different regions, different times of Mexico, and different emotions. You know, we have romantic music, we have happy music, we have music that describes and speaks about regions and cities and lifestyles in Mexico. So it is a true trip to this beautiful country through music.
Yeah, it's pretty much impossible to not feel or even move your body when listening to mariachi.
Yes.
It's obviously incredibly important to Mexican culture, the entire country. I'm just curious, what is the significance, if you can explain to listeners, of Santa Cecilia to mariachi bands?
Santa Cecilia, we see her as the saint of musicians. Santa Cecilia seems to be the most representative lady that bless the work of us mariachis. So in the religion of Catholic religion is mm-hmm. Santa Cecilia is a very special figure, and you know, people love to celebrate. We all even have a Santa Cecilia Day, and this is the musicians' day, mariachi musicians' day.
That is lovely. You're going to be going from organizer to performer. Tell us about Mariachi Bonitas. How long have you all been around?
I formed Mariachi Bonitas in 2020, in the middle of, you know, the whole craziness. I reached out to social media to look for ladies that were willing to be part of this amazing group. I knew since the very beginning that it will be a very amazing group. Back in 1997, I formed another female mariachi band, but that was in Los Angeles. That group was called Las Alondras. And, you know, I moved from city to city for school issues. But then I ended up in Sacramento. And 2014, I started the Mariachi Festival. I noticed that we didn't have this in the city. And I thought, this is super important to have. You know, we are the capital of the state. And why not to have a beautiful festival where people can get in touch with the roots and with the traditions? And if they have children that were born here, well, bring them. So they get to know much more about their ancestors, right, in the music and all that is part of Mexico. So I started Mariachi Bonitas to continue being part of, not only as a producer of the Mariachi Festival, but as a performer. Mm. And that is opening to totally, you know, the doors, not only for this Mariachi Festival, but for many others. We had the opportunity to stay, to be with Kelly Clarkson last year and this year.
I found that out this morning.
Yeah,
Donna
really?
Appadoni told me. She was so excited to have you on today.
It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Kelly is one of a very advocate for, you know, rights of women and opportunities for women. Mariachi music is known by being predominantly dominated by male musicians. So being a female mariachi musician is a privilege, is incredibly special for us. So we do it with extra work. When we work Mariachi Bonitas, we go 150%, no?
Yeah.
Our goal is not to be only one of the best mariachis in town, in general, but we want to be one of the best mariachis in the state. So we're working hard.
It's incredibly empowering what I'm getting from you. Well, let's listen to some of your music. Okay. Let's start off with Serenata Huasteca.
Canto al pie de tu ventana pa' que sepas que te quiero. Tú a mí no me quieres nada, pero yo por ti me muero. Dicen que ando muy errada, que despierte de mi sueño, pero se han equivocado, porque yo he de ser tu dueña. ¿Qué voy a hacer si de veras te quiero y ya te adoré y olvidarte no puedo? Dicen que pa' conseguirte.
I'm going to actually have you brag a little bit. You're an award-winning singer. You've actually performed with Stevie Wonder. You have traveled the world over 25 years, and I can completely understand why listening to you.
Thank you so much, Vicky. Yeah, I've been having the opportunity, immense opportunity, to share the stage with big people, you know, Stevie Wonder, Celia Cruz, John Secada, Boys to Men. Those experiences have been incredible. Also, you know, Mariachi Vargas, Mariachi Cobre. Music has been giving me the opportunity to be in the right place at the right time and sharing always, you know, the beautiful mariachi music.
Well, let's get to another song. This song is titled Esclavo y Amo.
No sé qué tienen tus ojos, no sé qué tiene tu boca, que dominan mis antojos, a mi sangre vuelve loca. No sé cómo fui a quererte.
You know, Denora, when you're talking about, you know, performing with Stevie Wonder, I think you said a Boys to Men, and Celia Cruz, you know, mariachi music, the genre, really transcends it being a Spanish genre and touches so many different genres. I think about when Vicente Fernandez passed away, George Strait, considered the king of country music, performed El Rey.
Yeah. That was incredible. Even Snoop Dogg.
Yeah. Oh, right.
played a little bit of his music as well. It is incredible how music can touch fibers, even though some people don't understand the language. It doesn't matter. It's just about feeling, and that's what I think mariachi music is. It touches your fibers and it makes you feel things that you didn't think you will feel. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
We're gonna listen to another song. This is La Malagueña.
Bonitos ojos tienes debajo de esas dos cejas, debajo de esas dos cejas. Qué bonitos ojos tienes. Ellos me quieren mirar, pero si tú no los dejas, pero si tú no los dejas, ni siquiera parpadear.
I want to end with, you were sharing with me some recognition you got.
Oh, yeah. You know, I got 3 Sammy's Awards here in Sacramento. I am very honored that the city recognized the hard work, because, even though, you know, it is music, people sometimes think that this is just my hobby. It is not. It is my full-time job. I have never done anything in my life but just music. I started being a professional singer when I was 14 years old back in Mexico City, where I am from, and never stopped. I never stopped working. Even during the pandemic, I would go outside of my, I live in a courtyard, so I just brought my guitar out there and I invite my neighbors to watch me and see me and hear the music from their porch. So it was beautiful, you know. I just needed to do it. So yeah, I'm very, very, very happy for these Sammy's Awards. I got 3 and inducted to the Hall of Fame of the this magazine, this newspapers.
Well, it is a gift, and thank you for sharing your gift with us, Denora.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
Denora Klingler is manager and lead singer of Mariachi Bonitas and organizer of the Mariachi Festival de Sacramento, which is taking place this weekend in downtown Sacramento. We have a link to all of that information on our website. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz, bouncing around, dancing in the studio. And Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.